Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Jonathan Earle about his 2017 book, Colonial Buganda in the End of Empire, Political Thought and Historical Imagination in Africa, published by Cambridge University Press as part of the African Studies series. Dr. Earle is Assistant Professor of African History and Chair of the African and African American Studies Program at the Center College. Dr. Earle, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I wonder if you could begin our interview by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So my interest in Eastern African history emerged as an undergraduate where I completed a couple of studies abroad in East Africa, one in Kenya, the other in Uganda. My summer abroad in Uganda, and this would have been in the early 2000s, coincided with a period in Uganda's political history when communities in eastern Uganda, communities in Teso land, where I was spending large amounts of time, were still living in the displacement camps after the Ugandan Bush War and the LRA insurgency in northern Uganda. But I was also spending large amounts of time throughout the Kingdom of Buganda in southern and central Uganda. So dividing my time between Buganda and Teso land brought me directly into spaces where I was fairly consistently confronted by two very different ways of remembering, different ways of talking about the Bush War of the 1980s, and more broadly, the politics of Milton Obote, whose government President Museveni and the NRA, the NRM, overthrew after a five-year conflict. So for Teso communities, generally speaking, they had been powerful supporters of the Milton Obote government. Gonda patriots, royalists in southern Uganda, by contrast, very much saw Obote as a destroyer of their ancient powerful monarchy. So these competing perspectives raised for me, you know, lots of different questions. How does public memory work? How do religious ideas and religious experience influence how people tell their stories, their biographies, and more broadly, how religion impacts how communities tell and write histories of violence, and how those histories and stories become standardized and circulated. So after graduating, I returned to Uganda for a couple of years, which provided me an opportunity to begin formally studying both Luganda and Ateso. And that really became the foundation that I built upon when I decided to do a PhD in African history at Cambridge University, where I went to study under Derek Peterson and a cohort of Eastern African historians that would have included John Lonsdale and John Iliffe.
Good.
So this is kind of how it all started.
And so from there, you know, how do you came to be interested in this particular project? What was the genesis of this project in particular?
Sure. When I began my PhD, I actually thought I was going to write a history on Anglican politics in early colonial Buganda. And I spent a better part of the first year of my doctoral research working in the institutional archives of the former British Empire, spending large amounts of time in the British National Archives in Kew, various archives throughout London, Cambridge, Oxford, Birmingham. But by the end of that first year, right before I headed out for a year of fieldwork, I had identified a number of political careers that were not really significantly active in the earlier colonial period, but were more active in the 1950s. And these biographies, this particular group of activists, captured my attention. And it's these activists that would eventually form the chapter structuring of the PhD theses, and then in time, the revised manuscript for the book. And I think what happened once I reached Uganda, I pretty quickly set about trying to see if I could find, track down any of the private papers that might have been left by these activists. And my hope was that these private papers would allow me to move beyond the framework of the institutional archives, which were mostly in English, and with this into kind of vernacular debates that were happening in the Kingdom of Buganda in the 1950s. And I was able to find private sources for a number of the activists that I had in mind. Ignatius Musazi, who was the founder of Uganda's first trade union and first political party, the Uganda National Congress. A moderate Protestant by the name of Eridadi Molira, who had been instrumental in drafting Uganda's independence constitution and whose career was confronted with numerous obstacles, including exile in the late 1950s. And the Muslim intellectual Abubakar Mayanja, whose career was kind of at the center of debates about royal patriotism, national politics, and the role of Islam in the state in the 1950s. And then a public healer by the name of Chibuka Chiganira, who had orchestrated a number of high-profile political demonstrations in the mid-1950s. And I think finding these private collections, in many ways, began to complicate for me a lot of the kind of the secondary literature that I had read up until that point, and that these private papers began to show just how complicated and pluralistic were the political and historical visions circulating in Buganda in the 1950s.
Good. And I wanted you to tell us a little bit about that particular part of the, you know, that particular goal in the book. Because I think and that's one of the parts that I found more interesting, you know, that you really do manage to sort of try to break away from this nationalistic histories or histories of nationalism, where there seems to be like an African side and a European side, and they don't necessarily seem to speak to one another, or even they're well defined. And I think one of the things that you demonstrate with Test Tax is that those distinctions don't quite actually work once we look at the evidence. So can you tell us a little bit about that historiography, how that historiography gets complicated by the stories that you tell about these men?
Yeah, absolutely. So each of these activists came from very different regions in the larger body politic that was Buganda, that was colonial Buganda. So Benedicto Chiwanuka, for example, who was Uganda's first elected prime minister, came from a section in western Buganda called Buddu. It was a preeminent Catholic political community in the state. Ignatius Musazi came from an area called Bulemezi, which was on Buganda's northern frontier, in relation to the Bunyoro pre-colonial empire. Eridadi Molira came from the area of Kochi, which by the late 19th century was a tributary state to the Buganda kingdom. And In turn, they were the inheritors of a particular type of politics that were localized to those specific regions. And those specific regions had different historic relationships to the center of power, to the Kingdom of Buganda. And each of these regions were producing different types of historical accounts in relation to clanship, in relation to kingship, and then in time, in relation to the introduction of international literacies, religious literacies, other literacies that were introduced through kind of the infrastructures of missionary education. And so what I was interested to see is that when these different activists acquired colonial literacy and began studying in missionary schools, they were exposed to religious literature, the likes of John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Harold Laski, in time. And they were reading these sources in ways that attempted to enrich and complicate the regional historiographies with which they were attempting to kind of assert new visions of political solidarity and kingship in the 1950s. And they also did so in ways that often blurred literary boundaries, European epistemological boundaries. Activists were very comfortable drawing from ostensibly religious or sacred and secular categories in ways that paid very little attention to how these would have been classified or taught within the context of missionary education. So in working with these international literacy, activists were quite comfortable drawing from having a Bible in one hand and Jean-Jacques Rousseau in another, or having the Quran in one hand and having the works of James Augury, the Ghanaian intellectual, in the other. So it was that blending of international discourses for the purposes of addressing and speaking to local historiographies that I found so interesting and insightful to the politics of the 1950s.
And, you know, can you tell us a little bit more about those politics? You know, how is it that, you know, what... Oftentimes, I think when we're writing intellectual histories, you know, they're in response to something. So what were the themes? How is it that the questions that they were asking were respond? What were the questions that they were trying to respond to?
Sure, that's a really good question. So between 1953 and 1955, the king of Buganda was sent into exile. Kabaka Edward Mutesa II, for his refusal to support a closer union or an Eastern African Union. There were very real public debates and concerns about Buganda and Uganda being overrun by a particular class of British settlers from within the context of Kenya. There had been much longer debates about the Swahiliization of Buganda politics, and so there were real public efforts to resist any sense of closer union with colonial Kenya. And when Mutesa refused to support these policies, essentially he was exiled to London, where he would spend the next 2 years. When he was exiled, Kabaka Mutesa was not a particularly popular king in Buganda. He found himself enmeshed in a number of marriage controversies of the period and was seen to be very much in alignment with British policies in the region in a number of contexts. This all changed with Mutesa's exile. Mutesa's exile in many ways was Buganda's anti-colonial moment. Out of the exile of the king, numerous patriotic movements emerged. And in many ways, it was the exile of Kabaka Mutesa that engendered the development of political parties in late colonial Buganda. So the question of kingship became a central question of public debate in the 1950s. And in turn, the activists that the book focuses on coming from different geopolitical regions of the Kingdom of Buganda, had very different expectations of what they wanted to see in their king and in their kingdom. So, again, public politics was shaped by these regional claims and were being informed further by international literacy. So Ignatius Musazi, for example, very much saw himself as trying to make the public case for a very strong monarchy, and that if Buganda's king would be endowed with nearly absolute rights, that this would put the kingship in a position to overthrow the British Empire in southern Uganda. And to make that case, he's drawing from a much longer historical tradition in the frontier of northern Buganda, where Balamezi, the citizens in the Kingdom of Buganda, or the subjects in the Kingdom of northern Buganda, saw themselves as the protectors of the Kingdom of Buganda. And in turn, it's going to begin making a public case for kind of the radicalization of kingship within Buganda politics. And to inform that argument, he's going to mine his Bible. He was a former Anglican ordinand, and is going to use his familiarity with Christian literacy to great effect to make the case for the importance of kingships within society. And that was just one vision out of many. One of his principal competitors was a moderate by the name of Eridadi Mulida, another Protestant intellectual, but who wanted to make the case for a much more inclusive vision of kingship. A kingdom where there was political space for multiple ethnic communities in Buganda during the 1940s and the 1950s, which itself reflected the political tradition that he had inherited as a member of the Kochi Kingdom, and a kingdom that was politically aligned with other regions throughout Uganda, Western Uganda, in a way that the Kingdom of Buganda historically had not been. And Benedicto Chiwanuka is another intellectual that the book looks at. And in many ways, his vision was one of the more radical visions of the late 1950s. The type of political intimidation that emerged in late colonial Buganda in many ways was directed against Benedicto Chiwanuka and the Democratic Party. That was Benedicto Chiwanuka's party. And really because they're calling for a radical reform of kingship and, if necessary, kind of Republican alternatives within late colonial Uganda. So Benedicto Chiwanuka was not opposed to the possibility of completely removing kingships. And if that's what was necessary for the purposes of creating a more unified, integrated Uganda, and of course for monarchical royalists, Buganda patriots, that type of public argument in the late 1950s was anathema to their sensibilities.
And now that you mentioned, one of the things that it's that you try to do in the book is, again, you know, diluting this distinction between sort of a secular sort of type of discourse versus a sacred discourse. And I thought it was, like the case studies that you chose obviously show how there was a pluralism of faiths, you know, that some of these, they're not only coming from different regions and sort of like you said, different clans, but also from a different background. So can you tell us a little bit more about historically, where this pluralism of faiths is rooted in the history of Buganda?
So Zanzibari traders reached the courts of Buganda by 1844, Protestant missionaries by 1877, and Catholic missionaries by 1879. When Zanzibari traders and European missionaries reached the courts of Buganda, they arrived at a a period of military political expansion, and a time in turn when there were large amounts of public debates taking place in Buganda about the expansion of the kingdom. By the late 19th century, at the life of the court of the Kingdom of Buganda, there had developed a culture of high competition where hereditary chiefs, where administrative military chiefs were in competition over acquiring public legitimacy and in time of the acquisition of land as well. And because, so in Buganda, religious missionaries and traders, their operations were largely confined to the royal court. The kings of Buganda, the administrators of the kingdom, largely legislated where missionaries were allowed to go, where they were allowed to stay. And in turn, this brought about large amounts of debate in the royal court where chiefs, clan heads, and converts began aligning themselves with particular missionary factions for the purposes of making these larger public claims. So very early on in Buganda, public politics, or I should maybe put it this way, that international religions get reworked into much longer, broader vernacular debates about power, authority, and public legitimacy. So much so that by the 1890s, there's a series of what some historians would call a civil war. It's a religious conflict in the early 1890s. In the first instance, between Christians and Muslim converts, and then in the second instance, between Protestant and Catholic converts, out of which ultimately Protestants are going to secure control of the state with the backing of British military armament support. And the chiefs who align with the British by the 1890s in many ways become the principal administrators of the colonial state. Protestant Buganda chiefs will acquire the largest land holdings in colonial Buganda. The largest amount of administrative positions within the state will be administered to Protestant chiefs. And two, Protestant chiefs will get very busy with writing official histories of the Kingdom of Buganda. And two of the more consequential projects of the period were written by two Protestant chiefs, one by the name of Apollo Kagwa, the other by the name of Hamu Mukasa. And they're writing extensively, and they're writing numerous types of works on Buganda's political history. And they're doing this for two reasons, no less than two reasons. The first is they're certainly trying to legitimize their own rule and the legitimacy of the Buganda monarchy to an international audience. They're trying to show British administrators that the Kingdom of Buganda, like Great Britain, ostensibly has a powerful ancient monarchy that had governed society long before the British stepped foot on Eastern African soil. And at a second level, there are many ways trying to make assertions of political legitimacy within the kind of the interior moral economy of Buganda politics. They're trying to make the argument that they are the legitimate inheritors of power in the Kingdom of Buganda, and that they are kind of a new class of political gatekeepers. And to do that, they're going to talk extensively about chronologies. They're going to rework Protestant literature. They're going to think in many ways about the political expansion that was taking place in the late 19th and the 18th and the 19th centuries. And essentially, they're going to try to make the case that they are the best equipped public leaders to stabilize the Kingdom of Buganda after this period of military expansion in the early to mid 19th century. At this time, there's a lot of public debate as well about a particular king by the name of Mutesa I, who in many ways was the principal king that brokered relationships between Zanzibari traders and Christian missionaries. But his initial name had not been Mutesa, it had been Mukabya, and which is a word in Luganda which can be translated a number of different ways. I think we can just, for the purposes of this conversation, just refer to it as one who causes tears or one who causes anxiety. But in time, he's going to become known as Mutesa, one who consoles, one who brings about a particular type of political stability. So by the early 1900s, Gonda activists are engaged in far-reaching debates about when precisely did Mukabya, this king, become Mutesa, because Gonda historians feel that if they can make the legitimate claim that their respective religious communities, whether they're Muslim, Protestant, or Catholic, were responsible for that particular type of conversion, this can become a way that they legitimize their governance before other Baganda throughout the kingdom.
I mean, that explains a lot. I mean, I was as I was reading, I kept asking myself, like, where does this, where does this conflict and this these claims to the past came? And that explains it very well. Can you also, one of the things that I thought was very interesting in terms of the structure, you know, you chose these five intellectuals, but I imagine that you had more material that you could have drawn from. Are there other figures that were not included in this piece, and why did you settle on these five in these four men? Sorry.
So the one activist who was in the original theses, who unfortunately did not make the book, was this prophet by the name of Chibuka Chiganira. He was came from a Catholic background. And in the mid 20th century, is going to have an experience where one of the principal pre-colonial spirits or gods by the name of Chibuka will possess him and compel him to enter into public politics. And this occurs largely between 1953 and 1955. And he is a really interesting activist at a number of different levels. In many ways, he's going to try to recreate the theatrics that had surrounded the earlier manifestation of Chibuka, the original god or lubale or spirit, find a section in Kampala, in the outskirts of Kampala, where he's going to climb a tree and begin prophesying for the return of Mutesa from exile. He prophesies with a snake around his neck. He, from his tree, will argue that he's able to cure women of barrenness. He's going to argue that he's able to talk through the wind to reach Mutesa, who's in London. And he attracts quite a significant following and certainly raises the alarm bells of colonial administrators who eventually will apprehend him, will arrest him. And it's not entirely clear what happens, but he's arrested and he's able to get out of prison and find himself to a series of rocks, really tall rocks in Kungu. And he's going to climb these rocks again, where he's going to continue to prophesy. And the stories that surround his public prophecy are simply spectacular. When I was conducting oral ethnography at the sites where Chibuka prophesied, communities would often talk about how a Ugandan crane had swarmed into the prison cells, and that he was able to climb on top of the Uganda crane and fly out of the prison to his eventual prophetic sites. Others talked about how two-headed snakes would appear to elevate the prophet as he gave hope of the return of Mutesa. And what's also interesting about Chibuka is that it was also educated elites who were very interested in his career and in his activism. There's a series of negotiations in 1954 and 1955 where the terms of the return of the king are stipulated, and some of the leading participants in the negotiations, these are called the Namirembe negotiations, are going to go and frequent the sites where Chibuka is offering his prophecies. And this causes a large amount of controversy amid the committee, who kind of saw themselves as the exemplars of a particular progressive Christianity that wanted nothing to do ostensibly with this this prophet. But unfortunately, as the book developed and took on some new components, and I wanted to develop a couple of different arguments within the book, it really seemed to be more fitting to publish as a journal article his particular career. Another area that I had set out on and was hoping that I was going to be able to do more with was kind of the history of women's activism in the 1950s. And to that end, conducted a number of interviews with leading activists, women's activists from the 1960s. But ultimately, if I was going to do it, I wanted to be able to do it well. And I wasn't able to get access to the type of materials that I initially had in mind. In some sections of the book, I talk about the politics of domesticity, but I think that's certainly an area where the book could be expanded more to think about kind of women's politics in the 1950s, and that's it. That's kind of an area of research that that didn't make it into the book.
And in terms of the work that is in the book, this for intellectuals, I thought it, when one reads it's a series of case studies, it's oftentimes and we think, well, that's a strategy to illustrate this plurality. But I think also you actually are able to connect them very well, they don't read like a disconnected set of case studies. They seem like they're part of larger debates. Can you just tell us a little bit more? You already talked about the debate about kingship. This notion of the problem of how to make this society, or at least the political culture, more inclusive is one of them, in the debates about citizenship. The contributions that come from the from the Catholic front and from the Muslim front to respond to like you said, this sort of dominion that the Protestant politicians had. So can you tell us how you weaved this actually much more unified story, than one would be led to believe when we hear case studies.
I wanted to be able to show and to illuminate a very real conversation and the conversations that were taking place. And the intellectuals or the activists who are featured in the book were very much in conversation with each other. They were at public rallies together for different reasons on different occasions, at different times, again, for different reasons. They're writing letters from time to time to each other. They're reading about each other in the Luganda and English press. And in many ways are trying to navigate similar types of constituencies, rural communities, clans. In some instances, they all go through similar educational institutions. So there was a certain, I don't think camaraderie is quite the right word, but certainly within the kind of the interiority of Gonda politics, there was this lively debate that was taking place where they were trying to contest public space. And so in many ways, this compels them to have to address questions and to debate mm-hmm. authority as it's being articulated by different factions and different communities in the 1950s. So I think that in the book, there's kind of an organic connection there. And I think that does reflect kind of the parallels that did exist as they kind of moved throughout Buganda and Uganda, trying to make the case for their particular movements or their particular parties, and then also kind of the larger visions that they were trying to advocate in the 1950s and the 1960s. And I think for me too, what I was trying to do with that was to problematize some of the earlier scholarship on intellectuals and what we precisely mean by intellectuals and what we mean by elites within a larger conversation about the end of empire. That while it was certainly the case that they were educated through missionary institutions, they were largely connected to very rural communities and were reworking arguments that were circulating within rural communities. My sense was that this complicated some of the ideas that had been made in the larger literature about intellectuals as simply being a, kind of a product of missionary education, but in ways that had largely distanced a particular class of industrial colonial elites from what was happening in rural contexts. So I tried to present them and to kind of think about them as cosmopolitan intellectuals who were navigating multiple arenas, arenas that overlapped, and in turn brought them into similar spheres of debate and discourse.
Good. And one last question that I wanted to ask is about your sources. You know, you mentioned how you went in search of these private collections. You make use of a lot of public records. One thing that is incredibly interesting in the book is how you read these materials. You know, you find not just letters, but you look at the marginalia and the notes and the class book notes of some of these men. So can you just give us a sense of you know, when you found these materials, how do you, did you realize, you know, this offers me this opportunity to read these materials in a new way?
I think when I began finding these libraries that accompanied the private papers, I didn't quite anticipate the extent to which these were rigorous annotators and precise annotators with the types of sources that they with the sources that they had in hand. So it made it possible, for example, in the case of Ignatius Musazi, to see when precisely he was reading a section of the prophetic book of Daniel in the early 20th century, or when Benedicto Chiwanuka, at what specific point he was actually reading and annotating Jean-Jacques Rousseau, because they were providing specific dates to indicate when they were reading these particular works. And in some cases, as they're reading, and this I think particularly comes out for Musazi, that as he's reading his books, he's very intentionally raising questions about Buganda politics in the annotations, asking questions such as, is this what's happening in Buganda now? Or in the affirmative, this is what is happening in Buganda now. So again, they're reading these sources with a clear ear to the ground of what's happening in Buganda. And so, of course, what one tries to do is to kind of follow the genealogies and the life of these particular ideas. Are the annotations working themselves out into public discourse? But at the same time, even beyond that, in what way do the sources themselves reflect a particular engagement with ideas that were circulating at the time? One of the questions I had to, initially wrestled with, were the annotations reflective? Were the annotations generative? In some cases, multiple colors are being used to underscore different sections of books and paragraphs, and just trying to wrestle with, so if in one section Musazzi is using a yellow pencil to highlight a section, and then he switches to use orange to underscore a particular section, was this just simply a question that he had accidentally dropped the yellow pencil and grabbed the orange one because it was the closest thing to him? Or was there actually some type of methodical study to what he was doing and using different colors to highlight different sections? And those types of questions, it wasn't always self-evident why particular colors were being used. But it was certainly a question that I wanted to think about and continue to think about. What do we as historians do with not only kind of the text of marginalia and kind of writing in marginalia, but also the aesthetics of marginalia as well, from color coding to the drawing of patterns? And then again, how does that reflect and shape particular political historical projects?
And how do you see that? I mean, like I said, sometimes we read intellectual history and it is not always clear how these ideas translated into events or decisions. How do you see this man or this ideas, these debates moving into, the transition to independence and the post-colonial period?
Well, I think in some cases, as they're working through these sources and translating these sources, one can very clearly make the connection between the production of political pamphlets, the writing of newspaper articles, the articulation of public speeches, that these reflect the general context that's being reflected on in these texts. And that what's happening as well in the public in public politics is shaping too the types of questions that these activists are bringing with them when they kind of sit down to read these texts, to think about these texts, and to debate these texts as well. And I think that's an important point as well, that in some cases, activists would go into private spaces to read their books. Benedicto Chiuonuca often did this. He had periods of the day where he would simply read to himself. But there are numerous cases, of course, where activists are coming together and they're debating and discussing the meaning and the interpretation of these particular types of texts. And those often gets translated into the Luganda press, the English press as well. Again, what to do with the question of kingship in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, for example. And of course, activists in the 1950s had very different ways of thinking about the kind of the question of, let's say, King David, and whether to what extent does the Bible try to condone kingship as opposed to overtly criticizing kingship in ancient Palestine. So those types of questions were, again, circulating widely in the Luganda press and in the public in the public sphere.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting. I think I've taken quite a bit of your time so far. Before we have to go, could you let us know what are you working on right now?
So I'm working on three projects right now. With three colleagues, I'm currently working on an edited volume on the decolonization of Uganda studies. This is kind of a part of a larger way of thinking with and interacting with larger debates in the academy right now on the decolonization of the curriculum. Second, with Jay Carney, my colleague Jay Carney, who is at Creighton, we've just completed a manuscript on the history of Benedicto Chiwanuka, who receives one chapter in the book that we've been discussing. But we use in this second book Benedicto Chiwanuka's career to rethink the politics of intimidation in 1950s Uganda. And with that, this in many ways is a project about how the martyrdoms that took place in the 1890s and the 1880s continued to shape public political debate throughout colonial Buganda. And certainly by the late 1950s and the early 1960s, there are extensive debates about the martyrs of early colonial Buganda. And so the book kind of investigates what was at stake in the standardization of particular ways of thinking about the Catholic martyrs, the Protestant martyrs, and Muslim martyrs as well. And what makes the martyrdom so interesting in Buganda is that community members from multiple parties are going to be killed by Buganda's kings for their disloyalty to the state. So in turn, multiple religious communities in Buganda had something at stake in kind of these public debates over martyrdom and how that was shaping anti-colonial discourse in the 1950s. And we're also trying to show in that book just the multiple Catholic visions that circulated not only in Buganda, but throughout Uganda more broadly. So this first book, the one that we've been discussing, is comfortably situated in many ways within Buganda. This new book is much more engaged with the making of modern Uganda and the politics of modern Uganda. And the final project that I'm working on, very early on, still a lot of work to do on it, it's a project on the global circulation of Eastern African political discourse. And what I'm specifically trying to do in this third, this book project is to think about how Eastern Africans impacted the emergence of political discourse in Great Britain and the United States on the eve of the First World War. And to do that, I focus on the political, we'll focus on the political careers of Winston Churchill and Theodore Roosevelt, both of whom had extensive journeys in Eastern Africa in 1907 and 1909, respectively. So, for example, if we were to think just about Roosevelt, Roosevelt visits Eastern Africa shortly after he served as president between 1901 and 1909. He's going to visit Uganda in Eastern Africa at a time that the Republican Party was being divided by white supremacy organizations, including the Lily White Movement, which sought to unravel liberal reforms following the American Civil War. And Roosevelt's time in Eastern Africa seems to problematize his understanding of Jim Crow laws, of racial hierarchies in the United States, on which he had largely been silent during his presidency. So Roosevelt, after he leaves Eastern Africa, he's compelled to leave the Republican Party and runs for a third term as an independent candidate. So I kind of use that in the larger case studies in the project to think kind of about the emergence of ideas of progress, civilization, and again, how Eastern African intellectuals were impacting these international discourses.
Well, I can't wait for that one. That sounds very, very interesting, challenging, but it definitely sounds very worthwhile. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. This was Dr. Jonathan Earle talking to us about his project, his most recent book, Colonial Buganda at the End of Empire, which, by the way, as a finalist for the Bethel Ogot Prize, which is offered by the East African Studies Association for the best book in East African studies. So thank you so much, Dr. Earle. We look forward to having you here in the podcast again to discuss some of your new books.
Thank you.